All right, we're going to talk about the courts today. And we're going to hit some of the really key moments in history that changed the attitude of the court system against Christianity, which is rather shocking, given the start of the United States. A lot of quotes this morning, and so you'll just have to put your listening ears on. So if you want to ask questions, as usual, do that. First, I want to start with a quote from James Madison. James Madison is considered to be the father of the Constitution and of the Bill of Rights. So this guy is supposed to know what the intention was behind all those things. He was very active in producing them. So here is something from the Federalist Paper, number 45. It was published in January of 1788. And if you don't know what the Federalist Papers are, they were a group of articles placed in newspapers to encourage the states to adopt the Constitution. And so they were explanatory. And so this is what he said. The powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. Those which are to remain to the state governments are numerous and indefinite. The former will be exercised principally on external objects as war, peace, negotiation, and foreign commerce. Now I'm going to break into the quote here. So according to the guy that was very much involved in writing the Constitution, he said the federal government's limited responsibilities are war, peace, negotiations of the same, and foreign commerce. Financial dealings between the governments of these United States and other governments. Back to the quote. With which last the power of taxation will, for the most part, be connected. Back, I'm going to break out of the quote again. So according to the guy that was involved in the design of the federal government, he said the federal government's power of taxation is chiefly going to be connected to foreign trade. Commerce. Now, back to the quote. The powers reserved for to the several states, like, you know, Pennsylvania and Virginia and all of those, will extend to all the objects which, in the ordinary course of affairs, concern the lives, liberties, and properties of the people, and the internal order, improvement, and prosperity of the state. End of quote. So according to him, the federal government has very little to do in the daily lives of people. That was the intention. It was the states who would fine-tune all of the things that would be going on in their territory as to how it would impact on the daily life of people. And you may remember that the 10th Amendment, which was promised to these people, actually said that anything not specified for the federal government was reserved to the states and who? Do you remember? The people. So if it's not specified in the federal government, the states get to make decisions about it, and the people, as individuals, get to make decisions about it for themselves. All right. Now, that's what he had said. Now, is that how we live according to the Constitution today? No. The federal government has seized more and more and more and more and more and more control. And they have insisted that they should do so. And we've, in our history, we've discovered that really came at the end of the 1800s, the beginning of the 1900s, with the progressive movement that preached this gospel that the that government is good and big government is better. And of course, you have to fund big government if you're going to do that. So that, I am going to tell you, as a student of history, was a violation of the original intent of the Constitution. And that's not me just saying that. That's the guy that helped write the bulk of it. Now, there was another thing said by another founding father in 1798. So the Constitution's been adopted. We've already gone through one president. We're now on to the next one, President John Adams. And he is making a speech to the Massachusetts militia, actually to the newly sworn in officers. And he's basically trying to encourage them to do their jobs well. And in the course of the speech, he makes reference to all the chaos that's going on in Europe at this point, particularly France, where they're killing people right and left. And they're making up new rules here and there. It's absolute mobocracy in France. And so he says that basically our government was designed to avoid that stuff through the Constitution. And then he says this final quote, "Avarice, ambition, revenge, or gallantry," and that's not gallantry in a good sense, that's a negative sense, "would break the strongest cords of our Constitution as a whale goes through a net. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." So his advice to the people here in this Massachusetts assembly is that we have to stick with our religious foundation or all is lost. Because it's not really the Constitution that keeps things in check here in the United States. It's our faith in Jesus Christ. It's the fact that all of our state governments, every last one of their constitutions, reference Christianity in some form or fashion. In fact, several of them maintain that you can't serve in government unless you verbalize that you believe that there's one God, Jesus is his son, and that the Bible is the inerrant, inspired word of God, both Old and New Testament. And he says, if we lose that, the Constitution's not going to do us any good. It'll be done. Now, I think that we're seeing the proof of that. Since the beginning of the 1900s, everything has been falling apart because of the abandonment of Christianity as the basis for our society. Now, the next quote that I want to give you comes from something that all of you are probably aware of. When State Senator from Illinois, Obama, was making his overtures for moving forward in public office in 2001, he was on Chicago Public Radio, and he was talking about the civil rights movement and the advances that they'd made in protecting the rights of the minorities. But he makes it plain that he does not think the Supreme Court, in their recent decisions, went far enough. And this is what he says. "The Supreme Court never ventured into the issues of redistribution of wealth and of more basic issues such as political and economic justice in society." All right, I'm going to break into the quote now. So Senator Obama at that time said, the Supreme Court didn't go enough because they did not step in and make money be taken away from richer white people and given to poorer non-white people. And they also did not practice what's referred to as social justice. If you don't know what social justice is an evil socialistic concept. It is, you punish the people who have more by taking away from them and giving it to the people who have less. And because now you're going to even the playing field from wrongs done in the past. Now the problem with that, of course, is the people you're taking away from didn't do anything. They just happen to be a certain color or a certain economic status. That's it. That's what targets them. But he believed that the Supreme Court should have gone in and done those things in the civil rights stuff. And then, this is the money quote, his attitude toward the Constitution. And it represents the attitude of many progressives toward the Constitution. Generally, the Constitution is a charter of negative liberties. Says what the states can't do to you. Says what the federal government can't do to you. But doesn't say what the federal government or state government must do on your behalf. See, his belief was the Constitution screwed up because it stopped government from doing stuff, which is correct. It did. You read the Constitution, including the Constitution of the states, and for the most part, it was shackles put upon governments. Because you see, our founding fathers believed that governments were typically prone to turning evil. That the more latitude you gave them, the more power you gave them, the more dangerous they became. One of the founding fathers referred to it as fire. It is a good servant until it gets loose, and then it burns up everyone. I think another one referred to it as like a chained dog, a chained watchdog. It's good unless you give it a long leash or let it get off the leash, and then it becomes dangerous to the people. But the progressives did not believe that. The progressives believed government is good, and the bigger the government is, the better. And of course, that's exactly what Senator and later President Obama believed and practiced in his government. And the next thing that we see that goes along with some of that, going back to the founding fathers, Alexander Hamilton, you recognize the name? He wanted to write in the Federalist Papers about how the Constitution was in charge. The Constitution was the document that controlled how government functioned, federal government. He said this in Federalist Number 78 from June 14, 1788. No legislative act, therefore, contrary to the Constitution, can be valid. So anytime the Congress tried to pass a law that violated the written Constitution, it would be invalidated because the Constitution trumped. A little bit more. It is not otherwise to be supposed that the Constitution could intend to enable the representatives of the people to substitute their will to that of their constituents. It is far more rational to suppose that the courts were designed to be an intermediate body between the people and the legislature, in order, among other things, to keep the latter within the limits assigned to their authority. The interpretation of the laws is the proper and peculiar province of the courts. A constitution is, in fact, and must be regarded by the judges as a fundamental law. It therefore belongs to them to ascertain its meaning, as well as the meaning of any particular act proceeding from the legislative body. If, therefore, it should happen to be an irreconcilable variance between the two, that which has the superior obligation of validity ought, of course, to be preferred. Or, in other words, the Constitution ought to be preferred to the statute, the intention of the people to the intention of their agents. Now, that's a long quote, but he basically boils it down to this. The Constitution in its written form always wins. And the court system should stand by that. That if there is some sort of contradiction between the written Constitution and a law, you always go with the Constitution's meaning. Now, that was the Founding Fathers' belief. But how many of you understood that there were people that were anti-constitutionalists? Did you know that? They were called anti-federalists. They were afraid of this constitutional government because they were afraid that no matter how many chains you put on it, it would break free and become dangerous. Robert Yates, in Anti-Federalist number 78, which, as far as I can tell, came out right around the same time as Alexander Hamilton's stuff, he warned that you could not trust a Supreme Court. This is what he said. The Supreme Court then has a right, independent of the legislature, to give a construction to the Constitution and every part of it. And there is no power provided in this system to correct their construction and do it away. If, therefore, the legislature pass any laws inconsistent with the sense of the judges, which the judges put upon the Constitution, they will declare it void, and therefore, in this respect, their power is superior to that of the legislature. The judges are supreme, and no law explanatory of the Constitution will be binding on them. So what he's just said is what has happened. He says, if this Constitution is adopted the way it is written, the courts will be the ultimate rulers of this country because they will be the ones that decide what the new laws mean. And they will decide it by saying, we think this is what the Constitution says. Now, isn't that where we're at right now? Almost every problem that we have as Christians today will eventually go back to some court decision where they turned and twisted the Constitution's wording. Sometimes they even said, well, doesn't matter what the Constitution says, we have to look at what the current world situation is. And that's what Yates warned about. This is the final quote from the excerpt. When great and extraordinary powers are vested in any man or body of man, which in their exercise may operate to the oppression of the people, it is of high importance that powerful checks should be formed to prevent the abuse of it. So his belief was there's not enough chains in the Constitution on the courts. And it turns out he was correct. We are in a mess now because of that. Now, there are some people suggesting adding new amendments to the Constitution to put those checks in. That the legislature, the Congress, should be allowed within a certain amount of time to review any Supreme Court decision and invalidate it by their own legislation. And of course, that would never be allowed by a Supreme Court because the Supreme Court believes they are the ultimate deciders of all law. And they decided that on their own in 1803. In 1803, this is a very famous Supreme Court decision. It's called Marbury versus Madison. There were only 4 members of the Supreme Court at that time. They did not have their own building because the legislature wouldn't let them have their own building for almost 100 years after the beginning of the United States. Do you know why? Because they didn't trust them. In fact, the place where the Supreme Court used to meet is in the Congress building right now, and it is used as a storage closet, part of it, and another part of it is just kind of a small committee room now. They wanted the the legislature wanted the Supreme Court to understand, you are not the boss of us. But that's not what the Supreme Court thought, because the Supreme Court basically says in Marbury versus Madison it is emphatically the duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. Those who apply the rule to particular cases must of necessity expound and interpret the law, and if two laws conflict with one another, the court must decide on the operation of each. And that is the argument that they've made for themselves since that time. And they actually eventually won that argument. It's part of the reason why they got their own building, I think, is because they wanted to assert themselves as being a much more powerful entity than what they were intended to be. So of Hamilton and Burke, Yates. We know that Yates is the one that turned out to be correct, that the Supreme Court eventually became the master of the country. Any comments or questions up to this point? Yeah. Pretty much everybody that was commenting on the Constitution would have been Christians, because the majority of Americans were Christians at that time. So yes, Yates was a Christian, but so was Hamilton, of a certain flavor. I don't remember which flavor each of them were. So it was basically, if you want to look at it that way, it was groups of Christians sitting around debating with one another whether or not we can trust future generations. And of course the answer is, no, you can't. You've got to put as much shackles on something to keep the individuals from getting too full of themselves. We have a very famous philosophical quote that we mention all the time. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So if people are going to be given authority, you have to put shackles on it to make sure that they don't abuse it. And just because you can trust the guy that's in the slot now does not mean you can trust the person who takes his place. That's a mistake that many of us make when we're dealing with the establishment of rules and government. That's right. Yep, it's exactly right. The big arguments, particularly amongst Christians nowadays, is we have to get a president in there that will give us our Supreme Court members so that we can make the laws. Whoa. The courts are not supposed to be making the laws. But they do, so we've got to jump in there too. Okay, let's just add to the chaos some more. Shouldn't we instead be putting people in legislative positions that will take us back to the original? Maybe even vote for putting some chains back on the Supreme Court? That might be the better choice. Yeah, it is hard. Well, see, this also gets to the problem, and I've had this debate with a couple of Christian lawyers. They thought that I was not being very realistic. But my thought is, I don't care what the precedent of the court is. What does the Constitution say? And what the lawyers ought to be arguing in front of these cases, or in front of the court, is a former court violated the Constitution, and you, sirs and ma'ams, need to go back to the Constitution instead of looking at some sort of court precedent. I don't care what a court said. What does the Constitution say? And you can give some examples of that. Dred Scott, the decision that made it pretty clear that there was no rights to be extended to people that were black and slaves. Was that a good precedent? Should the court still be living by that precedent? No. It was and should have been thrown out because it violated constitutional principles. But you won't hear court systems agreeing on that same idea of you've got to reject bad precedent when it comes to Roe versus Wade. In fact, we have supposedly conservatives who say, well, it's settled law, we just need to move forward. Excuse me? It's immoral. It's wrong. Those of you who don't know, Roe versus Wade was the decision that said that unborn children have no rights under the Constitution. I don't believe it's settled law. I think it is an aberration, an abhorrent aberration that needs to be expunged from our society. But you see, that's not the concept that our court system abides by today. It doesn't matter if precedent has been set, we have to stick with the precedent. And that's what Christian lawyers sometimes argue too. That's what the two guys I talked to tried to tell me. It doesn't matter, we just have to deal with what the court's already decided. No, we can't give up like that. You don't hear much about this Supreme Court decision. This is the one that puts the lie to much that you hear today. 1892. There were 9 members on the Supreme Court that year. It was a 9-0 decision. And here's the background of it. During that time period, we already talked about how a lot of people were saying, we can't let all these poor immigrants come in here and change our society, because they're coming in here and they're dragging the whole thing down. And so they were making rules about being very specific who could immigrate to this country. And you had to have skills, you had to be healthy, and usually you had to have a job ahead of time. Some other already citizen wasn't filling that slot. Well, the Church of the Holy Trinity, I don't remember which city it was in, but they wanted to hire a non-American preacher. And somebody said, you can't do that. That breaks the rules that are in place for immigration. And so the church took this through the court system until it finally arrived at the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court looked at it, and they said this as part of their answer. Beyond all these matters, no purpose or action against religion can be imputed to any legislation, state or national, because this is a religious people. Talking about the United States. This is historically true. From the discovery of this continent to the present hour, there is a single voice making this affirmation. And then they go through a whole bunch of legal documents from the Mayflower Compact onward. Toward the end of the decision, they say this: these and many other matters which might be noticed add a volume of unofficial declarations to the mass of organic utterances that this is a Christian nation. That's the exact words in the Supreme Court decision. How many of you heard people say, this is not a Christian nation, it's never been a Christian nation? You ever heard that? Well, the Supreme Court differed in 1892. In the face of all these, shall it be believed that a Congress of the United States intended to make it a misdemeanor for a church of this country to contract for the services of a Christian minister residing in another nation? So their decision was, you've got to be kidding me. You actually think, given the fact that this is a organically founded Christian nation, that the Congress would have made a rule saying, no, preachers can't come here from another country and preach? Mm-hmm. Yep. Now, that's interesting, because you see, the immigration laws get applied very judiciously in some areas, and totally ignored in others. Yep. Yep. Because there were so many hoops to jump through. Yep. They were rude bureaucrats. Oh, I'm sorry to hear all that. Yep. What year was that? 92? Well, you all know that, of course, immigration, illegal immigration particularly, is a big hot topic right now. And the ultimate goal of many people, both in and outside of the government, is to do away with any rules that would bar immigration. Basically take an open borders approach. And countries do not survive usually long after an open borders approach. Yep, it does not work. These are all examples of not learning from the past. That's correct. Well, they just go around, and then they're welcomed and told, well, we'll just make you citizens by fiat. So understand, a lot of the problems we have today are just things from the past that were not resolved appropriately. And that Supreme Court decision is probably the tail end of the constitutionalists, the ones who believe that the Constitution should trump everything. So 1892. Remember, at that time, that's when the progressives are starting to really make a lot of headway in the United States. So that's when all the Supreme Court decisions start taking a different flavor. 1920, Missouri versus Holland. This was decided 7-2. It determined that federal treaties always trump 10th Amendment states' rights. Because this was what was happening. The people of Missouri were shooting migratory birds and eating them. All right? And the federal government entered into a treaty with Canada that said, well, we're going to protect these migratory birds coming from your country to ours. And we're going to make those Missourians quit eating Canadian geese, I suppose, is what they were eating. All right? And so the court was asked to bring in on it, and guess what? They came to this conclusion. The treaty in question does not contravene any prohibitory words to be found in the Constitution. The only question is whether it is forbidden by some invisible radiation from the general terms of the 10th Amendment. We must consider what this country has become. Listen to that. We must consider what this country has become in deciding what that amendment has reserved. Do you understand what they're saying here? The court is saying we must allow our Constitution to change over time, to morph into what we're doing now. Now that goes totally against what our founding fathers said. They said that the government, or that the federal government, should be shackled by the Constitution very specifically. If they want to change the intended meaning of the Constitution, how were they supposed to do it? Amendments. How easy is it to get an amendment through? It is tough. And it was done that way on purpose. What's that? On the constitutional amendments, it's 2/3 of the states, I think, have to agree. Yep. So what happens instead is you start seeing this backdoor approach. We don't like the way that the Constitution reads, so we will get the court to say, well, we've got to look at that part of the Constitution differently. 1940, Cantwell versus Connecticut. And this is the probably the first time application of the First Amendment by means of the 14th to actions by a state. And it ends up being unanimous, 9-0. And what happens is, this is what Justice Owen Roberts says. To condition the solicitation of aid for the perpetuation of religious views or systems upon a license, the grant of which rests in the exercise of a determination by a state authority as to what is a religious cause, is to lay a forbidden burden upon the exercise of the liberty protected by the Constitution. Now, this is what was happening. Some cults were preaching and teaching non-Christian things. And the state of Connecticut said, you can't do that. That is against our Constitution. It is against our laws. And the federal government steps in and says, no, according to the First Amendment, you states can't decide who gets to preach what. Now, the reality is, whether you like it or not, the Constitution set it up where the states can decide on religious ideals. If a state wants to be a Baptist state and only let Baptists be in government, according to the original Constitution, they could. And the federal government could say a thing about it. If a state, God forbid, decided to become a Muslim state, the way the Constitution is set up, they could be a Muslim state. And the federal government couldn't have said a word about it. Michigan's about halfway there, at least in the Detroit area. But you see, the court decided that the federal government decides the First Amendment, not states. Now, that's not actually what the First Amendment says. First Amendment says that Congress shall make no laws affecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The federal government was supposed to keep their noses out of anything religious going on in the states. Is that what's happening today? Nope. 1947, Emerson versus the Board of Education. This was decided 5-4. And this is the first time misapplication of Jefferson's separation of church and state remark. If you're not aware of that, Thomas Jefferson was appealed to by the Danbury, Connecticut Baptists just right after he became president. The Baptists were hearing rumors that there was going to be a national church. And they didn't like that because they were all Baptists. And so they appeal to him to make sure that doesn't happen. And he says that can't happen because the federal government has a wall of separation between church and state. Now, what he meant by that was the federal government is the state in that comment. The federal government is barred by a wall from doing anything in that. Well, that's not the way that this Supreme Court decision applies it. 1947. The establishment of religion clause of the First Amendment means at least this: neither a state nor the federal government can set up a church. Did you hear that? They were accurate in the second part: the federal government cannot set up a church. But they were inaccurate in the first line: neither a state nor the federal government can set up a church. But that's incorrect historically. But this is a Supreme Court decision. By the way, it was 5-4. Neither can pass laws which aid one religion and aid all religions or prefer one religion over another. Now that is again incorrect on the state level. From the very beginning, and I've showed you them, the state constitutions all showed preference to Christianity. And some of them showed preference to a specific style of Christianity. And yet this Supreme Court decision in 1947 is saying, nope, can't have none of that. Neither can force nor influence a person to go or to remain away from a church against his will or force him to profess a belief or disbelief in any religion. Again, the state constitution started out very specifically doing that on many occasions. No person can be punished for entertaining or professing religious beliefs or disbeliefs for church attendance or non-attendance. Do you remember that some of the states actually had fines for not going to church? No tax in any amount, large or small, can be levied to support any religious activities or institutions, whatever they may be called or whatever form they may adopt to teach or practice religion. Again, many of the state constitutions had mechanisms by which state funding went to the support of the state-approved Christian faiths. Thank you. That is correct. The first Bible printed in the United States was ordered by Congress to be printed at the expense of Congress to be distributed to Native Americans and to help them to embrace Christianity as their faith. So this Supreme Court, at least the majority of them, 5-4, remember, is the decision, has blown all of that history out. They don't care. Neither a state nor the federal government can openly or secretly participate in the affairs of any religious organization or groups or vice versa. In the words of Jefferson, the clause against establishment of religion by law was intended to erect, quote, a wall of separation between church and state, end quote. So that is the first Supreme Court decision that misused that letter of Thomas Jefferson. And just so you'll know, Thomas Jefferson was not even in the country when all of that was debated for the Bill of Rights. So he was giving secondhand information even to the Danbury Baptists when he responded to them, although he was correct. The federal government can't step in and make a national church. But this Supreme Court decision blows away any of the historical reality of that comment by him. And that court's decision, by the way, became the precedent in every other decision that ever uses that phrase, separation of church and state. So the misunderstanding of it here becomes the law of the land in every other court decision thereafter. How about this one? 1963. I was a kid, all right? Abington versus Schmepp, or excuse me, I get this right, Schmepp Murray versus Curlett. Now, do you recognize the name Murray? Madeline Murray O'Hare, that is correct. She was one of the plaintiffs in this. This was decided 8-1. This is the decision that banned public reading, or banned Bible reading in public schools. And it's a really long decision, but it basically comes down to this, last line. Whatever Jefferson or Madison would have thought of Bible reading or the recital of the Lord's Prayer in what few public schools existed in their day, or use of the history of their time, must limit itself to broad purposes, not specific practices. By such a standard, I am persuaded, as is the court, that the devotional exercises carried out in Baltimore and Abington schools offended the First Amendment because they sufficiently threaten in our day those substantive evils that fear of which called forth the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. It is a constitution we are expounded, and our interpretation of the First Amendment must necessarily be responsive to the much more highly charged nature of religious questions in contemporary society. So in other words, those guys back in the past, yeah, They might have allowed public reading in their schools, but those were different schools than our schools today. And their situation back there is different than our situation today. And we have to bar any type of Bible reading in schools. And so that is the reason why it is supposedly unconstitutional, actually it's unjudicial, to allow Bible reading in schools devotionally. They can talk about the Bible in a comparative religion course, a literary course, but they're not allowed to start the day with a Bible reading because of that court decision right there. Mm-hmm. Yep. Not the way that they define it all, because they would probably today insist that if you're going to start the day with prayer, then you have to start the day with a prayer by a Christian, and you got to do a Protestant and a Catholic, and you probably have to get a Pentecostal in there too, and then a Muslim, and then you have to have a Buddhist, and you have to have somebody from this or that and the other. And then they would probably say, and that's just taking up too much time for school, so we're just not going to have anybody. Because that's also the approach that's been used in some environments. Yeah. Yep. It is very problematic. And what happened was this got all out of control in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when Bible-believing Christianity was shoved to the side. That's when it all started, and it's only gone downhill since then. Now, you've got somebody who dissented against this. Remember, this was 8-1? Justice Potter Stewart. He says, "It is, I think, a fallacious oversimplification in regard to regard the religious clauses as establishing a single constitutional standard of separation of church and state, which can be applied in every case to delineate the required boundaries between government and religion. As a matter of history, the First Amendment was adopted solely as a limitation upon the newly created national government. The events leading to its adoption strongly suggest that the Establishment Clause was primarily an attempt to ensure that Congress not only would be powerless to establish a national church, but would also be unable to interfere with existing state establishments." So basically, this is the only guy that was on the Supreme Court that was being constitutional. He's the only one that said, wait, this is what the Constitution really meant. "If religious exercises are held to be an impermissible activity in school, religion is placed in an artificial and state-created disadvantage, and a refusal to permit religious exercise thus it is seen not as the realization of state neutrality, but rather as the establishment of a religion of secularism, or at least as governmental support of the beliefs of those who think that religious exercises should be conducted only in private." And guess what? He was correct. Because of this 1963 decision, Christianity is barred from the public forum. Not just simply in schools, but pretty much everywhere. And secular humanism is accepted as the state, quote, religion or philosophy. Even to the point that you will hear people say the United States was established as a secular nation. So they have twisted the history around thanks to all these Supreme Court decisions. From that 1963 decision, things really did start down a much steeper slope of secularism of the United States and keeping Christianity from having a really effective impact upon society. 1970, this is one of the places that I am really ticked off at Ronald Reagan. Generally, I liked him as president, But in 1970, he pushed and then signed the California Family Law Act. And basically, California established no-fault divorce. Up to that point, all of the states had laws that basically said the wronged party can file for divorce. That is, if they've been cheated on, the biblical standard, basically. If they've been cheated on, they may apply for a divorce and receive all the appropriate financial support from the perpetrator of the crime of adultery. That was the standard across the states ever since colonial days. But President Reagan, who was a divorcee himself, pushed this so that you can get divorced for any reason whatsoever in California, starting in that year. 77, 9 other states had adopted it. By 1983, everybody except South Dakota and New York had adopted it. And the Census Bureau has revealed to us that the divorce rate skyrocketed because of this. Until today, this is a little bit old information. It's a little bit worse yet. Divorce rate in America at the time of 2000 was, for the first marriage, 41%. So 41% of marriages end in divorce. If they get remarried, second marriage divorce rate, 60%. Third marriage divorce rate, 73%. And you can see that it probably just keeps going up from there. Very problematic. And of course, what was the natural reaction to, okay, marriages are ending in divorce. What's the next natural philosophical reaction? Why get married? We'll just live together, and if problems arise, we'll just agree to separate, and then we don't get the courts involved in it. And that's exactly what you see. 1970, about 530,000 couples were supposedly living together. In 1980, it was 1.6 million Americans. 1990, 2.9 million Americans. 1998, 4.2 million Americans. 2000, 5.5 million Americans. I did not go and check to see what it is today, but I guarantee you it is higher than it was then, because it continues to go up. And a lot of it relates to this idea that Christian morals no longer hold sway over American society. In fact, if you object to people living together, what's more than likely going to be the response of those people and any of their friends to you? Mind your own business. Why are you living in the dark ages? That sort of stuff, right? All right, 1973, I already talked about this. Roe versus Wade was decided 7-2. That abortion on demand was a fundamental right protected by the Constitution. Now, do you think that our founding fathers would have considered abortion a fundamental right? Nope. Every last one of the colonies and then every last one of the states have laws against abortions. And so there's no way in the world that they would have gone along with that idea. But you see, the Supreme Court made this up out of what's called the shadow of one of the other amendments dealing with the right of privacy. So it had nothing to do really with anything from the Constitution. It dealt with a state, with the court saying, well, there's this fundamental right hiding in the shadow, I think, of the 14th Amendment, that has this right of privacy. And so if a woman wants to have an abortion, that's none of your business. And to this day, because of Supreme Court decision 1973, you can go and have your pregnancy terminated right up to the day of delivery. And in fact, in some places, they will do a late-term abortion by bringing the body of the baby out but leaving the head inside so that the birth has not yet taken place. And then they will jam a pair of scissors up into the skull, scramble the brains, suck the brains out, and now that the baby's dead, the deed is done. So then they pull the baby out the rest of the way, and no legal problem, because it was all done ahead. I'm sorry I offended some of you by describing it that way, but that's the technical way it's done for late-term abortion. And we are not far, because of that, to the standard of the Romans, which the Romans basically said, you can kill the child up to the point where dad says, I accept the child as mine. So even if they were kindergartners, they could have done that. It's very sad that we've gotten to that point. That pretty much brings us to the end of our time that we got here this morning. But I wanted you to see that where we've lost the most ground as Christians is in the court system. And the way that we lost it in the court system is because the court system went exactly the direction some of the founding fathers warned it would go. That it would get out of control and would thereafter be utilized by those that wanted to abandon the wording of the Constitution. And that is exactly where we're at. And I really have no good words to tell you as to hope how that's going to change. Because even some of those who claim to be conservative in our country will support the idea that when a judge goes off to the Supreme Court who is liberal, that's a liberal seat. We should allow a liberal judge to have that spot to maintain the integrity of what we've become as a nation. And it just frustrates me to no pieces that we've come to this place. The only answer is we got to pray and wait for the second coming of Jesus Christ. I think it's got a lot to do with it. That will be the only resolution to bad government, is the government of Jesus Christ. Yeah. Well, you know, that would involve us convincing our fellow citizens to do that along with us. Yeah, and that's what we have to do. And I think that's partly why I do this sort of stuff. See, some people don't like the fact that I do, like, a history section in a Sunday school class because you ought to be teaching only Bible. Well, I think this helps us understand more of what the Bible warned about, that in the last days, people are going to get this way, and we're going to have to deal with that. And we're going to have to be a witness in the midst of all that. So yeah, we should be praying, and we should raise our own children to understand that a lot of the stuff that's being promoted is not correct. It is inaccurate. I am not a big proponent of sending your kids to public school, folks. I'll just tell you that. We had our son at a private Christian school the first half of his education and let him go to public school in his high school part, and you know what? If I had to do it all over again, that would not have happened. We would have driven out of our way in order to make sure that he had gone to a Christian high school because it's a dangerous time, a person's schooling years, to formulate a lot of their thinking processes. And those guys are out there as change agents to change the concepts. Now, what about Christian teachers in public schools, like this lady back there? Yes, go there. Do what you can to keep the thing from going too badly, okay? I would not send my own kids or grandkids to a public school now. It just wouldn't happen.